we'll get into it. Let's pray. Father, in Jesus' precious name and by the grace and mercy of your Spirit, thankful that we can gather in your name and talk about your word and how important it is to defend it, to know it, to love it, to share it. I pray that all of us would be challenged to share our faith and with the things that we've learned from here. Pray this in Jesus Christ's name. Amen. If we've never met, my name is Matt. I wrote my dissertation on the connection between hero myth and natural law. And that began I've always been very interested in mythology, specifically hero myth. But it was in the dissertation where I started focusing on mythology in a more academic sense that I became fascinated with it. It's kind of interesting. It's like my dissertation put together all of these different ideas, and they're all really big ideas. And so I had to spend so much time on each of these things. Usually what happens is somebody writes a dissertation, they're like, I'm going to become like an expert on myth. Well, for mine, I had to become like an expert on a bunch of different fields. So it took a lot of extra work because I focused on mythology, ethics, natural law, literary criticism, and biblical criticism. And I kind of had to put all of these together to synthesize it to obtain my thesis. One of the things I started noticing when I was doing my research for my dissertation and focusing on mythology was I started coming across more and more is how much did the biblical authors, whether from Genesis all the way up to Revelation, how much of them were influenced by pagan mythology or pagan philosophy. So I'm going to talk about that today, what aspects were influenced the biblical authors and which stuff most likely did not. In many respects, this is a precursor to a talk on the Jesus mythicist movement. Now, if you guys don't know what that is, it's becoming more and more popular nowadays. It's the idea that Jesus never existed. And Doc has spoken on this. You've been speaking on this a lot recently, haven't you, in your talks? Yeah, so the last couple of years, it's starting to get more and more. Two main guys in the field right now that are arguing for this are Richard Carrier and Bob Price. But there's been a couple other. G.A. Wells was a guy. He's written some stuff. It's funny, you know who actually has the best reputation of the Jesus myth? Who do you think I was going to say? Yeah, Bart Ehrman. If you guys don't know who Bart Ehrman is, he's a brilliant New Testament scholar. Very brilliant. And but he wrote this book called Did Jesus Exist? And it's by far the best refutation of the Jesus mythicist movement. And it was written by a guy who thinks part of the New Testament, majority of it, has been corrupted, or that we had lost it, or you know, we had been influenced to the point where the scriptural integrity has been lost. So it's funny that this guy is the one who wrote on it. So anyways, as I was preparing for this, I started coming across these ideas of the Jesus mythicist movement, and so I became fascinated about, all right, well, what parts could it be possible for these biblical authors to be influenced, and what parts is it not possible for them to be influenced? And that's kind of what my talk is going to be about today. Now, usually when I do these type of talks, I over-prepare so much. You know, like, I mean, the last time I did a PowerPoint presentation, I think I had like 50 or 60 slides. And so I was like, all right, I'm not going to do that today. I want to do one third of that. So I have a lot fewer slides than I normally do. So hopefully that means I will just be able to kind of ask questions more and respond. Now, if you've never heard me talk before, I'm a Socratic method teacher, which means I like to ask questions and I like responses from the audience and stuff. And plus two, I always like to be like, if there is like these any apologists like in the audience and they've been like studying the subject and they're just waiting to say like some nugget that they've learned. And so I'll ask some obscure question, just in the hopes that there's someone out there being like, you know, ask me something on the ontological commitments of the, you know, just someone that's just the most obscure thing they're hoping for. It's like, you know, one of these days I'll make somebody's day. So, so if you have any questions, like I said, just go through and just ask, and we'll take it from there. So, what I want to start with, and it seems kind of strange, but is that I want to define mythology. The reason why it's so important for us to understand myth is we have to understand when we are interacting with something and how significant it is. Now, let me tell you this. I'm going to say this, and then I'll explain a bit. But the Bible is a myth. The Jesus Christ is a myth. Now, we don't like to say that because our initial notions of mythology means false. That's not really the classical understanding, or really even the full understanding of myth. Let me start defining it, and then I'll explain the significance of that. So it's kind of funny. It's like, you know, we're in this conference about fighting for the integrity of the Bible, and I'm here saying the Bible's a myth. I am a complete inerrantist in the classical sense of the word. I believe that the Bible is completely inerrant. I don't think that has anything to do with the fact that the Bible is a myth. Just real quick, just explain what a myth is. It's something that tells you something significant about your life, or the crucial factors that come together that form all the different aspects of your worldview. In a sense, that is what a myth is. So let me explain it, and let me define it. In the most basic sense, etymology of the word myth, it just means story or discourse. So in the more fundamental level, myth just simply means to communicate. Now later, it became associated with false things, stories about dragons, about fairies, and stuff like that. What other initial notions do you have to mythology? If you hear this term, what are some other like immediate notions that come to your mind? The what?
Greek mythology.
Greek mythology. Yes, yes. What else?
Oral tradition.
Oral tradition. Yeah, a lot of the times, and this is we'll talk about it later. But it's not just the oral tradition. The myth itself is the oral tradition. But as I'll explain later, you can't have a myth without a ritual. And all myth has to be connected to either what I call either to a ritual or a disposition. I'll give you a quick example. So like a ritual would be something like the Eucharist. The ritual itself, the partaking of the bread, of the wine, that is the ritual of it. The myth is the story behind it, you know, of Jesus taking the bread, and on the night which he was betrayed, you know, he took it and gave thanks and broke it. That's the myth part of it. It's the idea behind the ritual, and the ritual is kind of where all the theology comes from of the thing. We're going to talk about later one of the reasons why I'm going to argue that the pagan philosophy did not influence the Bible is we're going to talk about 10 areas of theology that are vastly different between the theology that you'll find in the Bible and the theology that you'll find from these false pagan myths. All right, what else? What other ways do we refer to a myth if we say that's a myth?
Heroic,
yes. So one of the things I like to say is it's like it's kind of like something a bigger. It's bigger. It's like we think of someone as a myth, of like a heroic myth. We think what they did was so fantastic, it's almost not believable. You know, we have that phrase, the man, the myth, the legend. It's someone who's better at something. We'll go there. I'm getting a little. I see what happens. I get excited and I skip my notes and I start going on. So I just say the most fundamental definition of myth is communication, but later it started being associated with dragons and the fantastical and whatnot. Now, some of these are actually, I stole these from my, some of these are actually just quotations from my own dissertation. This is the nice thing is you can't really like plagiarize yourself. So I can quote me there and don't even have to put the reference. It's pretty fun, you know, because usually, you know, you always have to be like, well, this person said that. I'm not that smart. Oh, speaking of not that smart, If you want to be able to know 80% of what I'm going to talk about today, just read these two books. This is going to have almost everything in there that I'm going to copy. Shows you what's on my mind, you know, coffee. But we have Ronald Nash, The Gospel and the Greeks. This is just a brilliant book. Nash in general is, if you want to know what a scholar is, read this. Nash is a legit scholar. Now this one is a little bit less well known. John Oswald, The Bible Among Myths. Fantastic work. He explains like how the Israel would respond, how they would understand these different concepts when they're presented with these false ideologies. And he does a really good job of defining myth. In fact, I think his chapter on myth says, like, defining the undefinable, but that, no, maybe it wasn't this book. Oh, he calls it a problem of definition. Because everyone you read that tries to define myth, they will tell you the same thing. It's almost impossible to define because it's so broad. And I'll get into that in a second. Any questions so far? How's my speed? Am I too fast? Am I going too fast? Okay. Sorry, I just get excited. Okay, so it's interesting. Is I said a myth can refer to an old wife's tale that is false. Or it could refer to an old wife's tale that is true. They're both in that same sense myths. So this means that the status of myth is not contingent or is not dependent on something being true or false. Something doesn't have to be true. If something is true, it doesn't mean it can't be a false. It can't be a myth. And if something is false, it doesn't mean that it must be a myth. So I gave the example of, you know, don't swallow your gum or else it'll remain in your stomach for 7 years. Well, that is a myth because it's an old wives tale. It is the passing on of information through a story. That's the myth, the intercourse. But this idea that it's trying to portray is false. So it would be an example of a false myth. Then you have an example of a true myth. Have some tea with honey because honey will help soothe your sore throat and it acts as a cough suppressant. That's an old wives' tale because it is a saying, something that goes back in time, but it is an example of something that is true because honey is demonstrably something that helps with cough resistance. So a myth can either be something that is true or it can be something that is false as well. So the example, my mom used to always tell me this story growing up called The Boy That Cried Wolf. Does anybody know this story? So this is a great example of a myth that is meant to not bring about a ritual, but a myth that's supposed to bring about a disposition or a specific way of reacting. Examples of this in the Bible, parables. Parable is an example of a myth. It's a discourse, a story of discourse, that's not associated with a ritual. It's not like the Eucharist. It's not like marriage. It's not like a funeral. But it's meant to have you bring about a certain mindset, a certain idea of patience, of being, you know, a good steward, someone who doesn't just take his money and bury it in the ground, but rather someone who invests it. So the myth there is the story, and the disposition is what you're supposed to be left with. And that is the idea that you should be taking what is given to you and invest that to try to increase it. So the parable itself is the myth. How we're supposed to react to it is the disposition. So now there can be two examples of how this is a myth. So The Boy That Cried Wolf, it's an example of there's this kid playing outside. Everyone knows that if there's a wolf in the area, you just call for help and everyone will come and save you. You know, they're this village out in the middle of nowhere. But this kid, he just liked all the attention of crying wolf. And so he would cry wolf when there was no wolf. Everyone would come to try to protect him. But then he would laugh and say, ha ha, there's no wolf. And so then they would leave upset. Well, after a couple times, they realized, hey, he cries wolf. We're just going to get laughed at. Let's not even show up. And so that's what happened. But this time the kid actually saw a wolf. And so when he cried wolf, no one would believe him because of his past actions. So the myth itself is the story behind the boy that cried wolf. The disposition it's supposed to bring about is one of there are consequences to lying. But now this same thing could be achieved if someone said, well, hey, let me tell you about a story about a boy named Tommy. And let's say the same thing that happened to Tommy is the same thing that happened to the boy in the story. That, say, he was in a village, he would always call he would say, oh, there's wolves here, when there was no wolves. Finally, the village ignored him, and then he got eaten by wolves. So in this sense, you have the false story, still equally a myth. And then if a father told a story about something that really happened that was almost identical to that, it would still be a myth. Again, myth is not concerned about the veracity or how true or false something is. So it's interesting, but you can be a myth for... Well, let me explain it this way. Someone could be a myth because they have all of these, deeds ascribed to him. Like, he's a myth because he's so fast, or he's so tall, or he's so smart. You could be a myth because all those things about you are true, but you could also be a myth because those things about you are false. He's like, this guy is a myth because he thinks he is so smart, so funny. He thinks he's like this ultimate superhero or whatever, and he's ultimate, and he actually is not. Well, that would be another example of a myth. And it's funny because you could even have myths within myths. You could have a story that includes like dragons and whatnot, and that makes it a myth. But yet also within that, there could be a person who is set apart because of his skills, either actual or not, which would make that, in a sense, a myth within a myth. And you see that within the Bible. Like I said, the Eucharist is, think about like the Eucharist and baptism are probably the quintessential examples of mythology within the Bible, because they're very clear. This is what you do. This is your mindset. This is the action itself, and it's supposed to bring about this. So those are myths that are within the Bible, but the Bible itself, because it is used to formulate our worldview, it in a sense acts as a myth as well. All right. Any questions? Okay. So, I pretty much give this. In a technical sense, in a general sense, a myth is associated with a rare or unique people or events which may or may not have been accurately observed or accurately preserved. Basically, things that could or could not have happened. In the technical sense, it is a narrative associated with a ritual or a disposition. Now, this is kind of... we don't usually think of things in terms of what they are not. But when it comes to mythology, I do have to explain what it is not. Mythology is not garbled history. So what I mean by that is mythology is not like, oh, once there was a story about Bob and he came to town and he bought an axe. And then 100 years later, there was a story about Bob. He came to town, he bought an axe, and he chopped down a tree in 5 minutes. And then another 100 years go by. There was a guy named Bob, and he bought an axe, and he chopped down 100 trees in 5 minutes. So what I mean is our natural way of understanding mythology is to think that it is something that was relatively simple, and then through time it became bigger and more grandiose until it became almost unbelievable. That in no sense is what mythology is. And in fact, when you start studying what I refer to as the primordial myths, like the earliest myths, what we find here is there was strict adherence and strict roles behind these myths. Okay, think about it this way. Have you guys ever watched any of those videos on YouTube or whatever where it shows like the tomb of the unknown soldier? Or have you guys, anyone visited the tomb of the unknown soldier? Or okay, so did you go through like the whole like where they showed like the changing of the guards and stuff like that? What do you think what would happen if maybe you went down there when they were explaining all this stuff, when they were doing, saying, you know, reading the roll call? What if you went down there and you started saying your opinion on what you think about the state of the military today? Do you think they would accept that as a part of an acceptable segue into what you have to say?
It would be a harsh condemnation to respect the honor and dignity of the tomb of the unknown soldier.
Yeah, they would freak out. I mean, I saw this one video, and they were said, there's a fence here, and they said, you do not go on this side of the fence. You're over here. Somebody dropped a water bottle, and it fell over and onto like the formal area. And as like the head old guy is, you know, he's giving his talk, it's, you know, the guy who's been in the military for 60 years. And in the middle of this talk, one of the armed guards, he just goes, does this thing. And he's like, all guests will remain on this side of the, and he like just like screamed it out because someone tried to reach past the into, you know, the sacred area just to grab a piece of trash. And these guys freaked out on them and said, no, this is a part of this ritual. You are playing no part in it. So as serious as we see, like military, any sort of military ritual, or even in some senses, you know, where you go to a wedding and it's like a funeral, you know, and they're just like, you know, stand up, sit down, fight, fight, fight. And it's just all these, you know, big, all these rituals. And now we do the candle. Well, all those are taken very seriously. And in the ancient mindset, it was very serious. Lord Raglan, if you guys have never read him or heard of him, he was kind of like one of the big, you guys know who Joseph Campbell is? Have you heard of Joseph Campbell? If you like Star Wars, thank Joseph Campbell, because he's the one who gave, well, it's funny, like all the reasons why Star Wars was successful has almost nothing to do with George Lucas. George Lucas just happened to be the guy at the center of it, and he had Joseph Campbell telling him all this stuff about the hero mythology and stuff. And I think it was George Lucas's wife, and she's the one who came up with like all like the trench run and lightsabers. The more you look into it, anyways, George Lucas, I mean, yes, he's very important, but not as important as some of this other stuff. But before Lucas, probably Lord Raglan was probably the most well-known mythicist. And one of the things that he said was, has anyone ever here been to like Hawaii, and they have like, you've gone to like a luau and stuff like that before? And they always have that MC on the mic, you know, and he has like I remember he had these jokes of like, hey, if your father served in, you know, Pearl Harbor, you know, I'm still looking for my dad. So if you know, it's like, he's, you know, telling these jokes about like, you know, these GIs that were there. And it was funny. But anyways, Lord Raglan talks about this, and he says, you know, when we go and look at these people who are telling these jokes, and they seem like they are like these off-the-cuff jokes, but really, it's a part of this, those jokes that he has told over and over again, night after night. It's, in a sense, a part of the ritual. And we look at it, and we think, oh, it's just kind of, they're winging it, when in actuality, it's like, no, they're not winging it. He has this set way to bring about these jokes. It's a part of his ritual. And so the same thing too with the rituals that are associated with mythology are very, very specific, to the point where the same way we can't just jump in and change a military ceremony, these people would have never even considered jumping in even to like a religious, even though we consider religious ceremonies to be more changeable, they would have thought the opposite. They would have thought it likely to change a religious ritual would be like us trying to say we're going to change, you know, some ritual that the Marines did. Like, what's a ritual that the Marines did that you don't think is going to be changing anytime soon?
I don't know.
Yes, exactly. And there's a very way, specific way to do that. And there's a way that if you're not involved with the Marines, you have no business of even touching that. Yep. So, and think about this. The likelihood of a Marine changing the way he would fold his flag would be like the way that the ancient religions would change their rituals. That's how serious they were. Yes.
Of America.
It's that, you know, it's a good point. Like my friends now, I mean, obviously I'm like someone else. I have everyone has an opinion on it. And they said, well, that's not disrespectful. And I was like, yes, it is. It has to be disrespectful because the only way you can understand respect is in the context of a culture. And in the context of military culture, it's an issue of respect that when the colors are raised, you stand up. So you can't, there's no way that you can say that it's not disrespectful because it is, because the culture decides what is respect. So it is disrespectful for them to do that. The question is he free to do that? Which is another issue altogether. So mythology is not a speculative explanation of natural phenomenon. You know, we love to think of the idea that we hear, we see like lightning strike and we're like, oh, the gods are mad. From what I can tell, I have not been able to find a single instance of mythology that began as a natural explanation, as an explanation of natural phenomenon. In fact, what I found is the opposite, is that people would hold to certain religious rituals and myths despite them knowing that they were demonstrably false. But again, remember, like what I said before, is the truth of the myth is not important. See, what's important in myth, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, but I want to explain this now, is the goal of myth is to bring about what I refer to, or what many people refer to as transcendence. And what I mean by transcendence in this sense is myths are supposed to bring about feelings of otherness or feelings of significance. So on most days, you know, you might get up and you go and do your coffee and you do your thing, but on a day in which you are going to participate in a ritual, let's say your son's wedding or your daughter's graduation, those are more significant days because they represent significant stepping stones in somebody's life. That significance is what is transcendence. It's that idea of there's something greater, something bigger than this normal everyday life. This is what religion hopes to bring about. Religion wants to bring out a sense of transcendence, a sense of greatness, a sense of otherness. And so this is where I differentiate Christianity between these religions, is these religions, false religions, they can only bring about what I refer to as sentiments of transcendence. And what I mean by that is it brings about ideas of significance, but they're not actually significant because they are false. Whereas Christianity doesn't produce sentiments of transcendence or ideas of transcendence, but rather it actually brings about transcendence. With Christianity, you don't have just ideas of significance. With Christianity, you have, I can come boldly to the Father. I can boldly before the throne of grace. You have true transcendence, true otherness. And that's why C.S. Lewis referred to Jesus as the true myth. Because he actually, what he did was able to not just produce ideas or sentiments of transcendence, but to bring about actual transcendence. All right, I am so far behind. I don't know why I think I always do this. Every time. I've never once not over-prepared for a talk by like 3 hours. But I'm like, I'm still like, this is what I considered my introduction, but. Okay, we got it. We're going to get through. We'll get through this. But hey, I hope you guys are learning stuff. Either way. Mindless religious repetition. One of the things you'll see is what you'll see in the difference between ancient Near East mythology and all mythology in general and the Bible is the difference what we'll see is between what I call is magic words and prayer. There's a reason why Jesus says that when you pray, you should not use vain repetitions as the heathens do. Because in the ancient Near East mindset, prayer in most religions was mechanical. And what I mean by that is if I went to open this door, I come over and I push down this knob and then I push open and it opens. It's a series of mechanical processes. In pagan religions, It was like a rub-a-dub-dub, thanks for the grub. You say this thing and you get something in return. It's a mechanical response. Whereas with Christianity, it's not a mechanical response. It is, you come before God in prayer, you make your petition, and then God says, I'm sovereign over life and death, I'll decide whether I'm going to act on it or not. Whereas in the pagan world, it's like that's how they would, in a sense, show their superiority over these different pagan religions, like in Haiti, like you dealt with, because in this is Victorious, my godmother, when they were missionaries in Haiti, they dealt with people who would have like this. I'm maybe gonna explain it wrong, but there was like they had like a hierarchy of pagan gods, right? And they would kind of like say, well, this pagan god beats this pagan god, right? So it's almost like there was like this like pagan chess piece. And you're like, if I have all these right pieces, then I'm protected from this person casting spells on me. Whereas with Christianity, it's like, the creator of the universe has got my back, do your best, But that's the difference between mindless religious repetition is trying to bring about the mechanic of, as opposed to the work behind it. It's not a product of evolution. In fact, it's so funny. It's so many of these atheist philosophers or atheologians, they are huge into Darwinian evolution, but they will not touch it with a 10-foot pole when it comes to creating their ethical system. And the reason why they won't do that is because a process that rewards those who are fit enough to pass on genetic information, believe it or not, is not a very good metric to determining how good somebody is. Or what I mean by that is, just because somebody can pass on their genetic information, that doesn't mean that person is morally good. And in fact, if you're going to try to base moral goodness off of who can pass on genetic information, that's not going to end well. I'll tell you that.
I would say 33% of atheists, according to a poll, look at science, hashtag science, for their morality.
Yeah, that doesn't mean anything. It was like the guy that was debating Craig. Was it Craig? No, it was Frank Turek. I don't remember who it was. But they were saying there could be something beyond nature and it could be more nature. That's like, that doesn't work like that. If you say there's something beyond nature but it's just nature, you're just saying there's really nothing beyond nature. What? I don't remember. Again, mythology is not a story. Mythology requires a story, but it is not a story in and of itself. And it is not a religion. Now, one of the things, is this the next slide I have? No, it's not. One of the things I'll say is it's almost impossible to differentiate between the origins of mythology, morality, and religion. You cannot really differentiate between those because anything that would bring about one of those will bring about the other ones. So anything that, any sort of divine influence that would bring about myth, religion, or morality would be something that would bring about the other two as well. So all I say that to say is myth, religion, and morality are very similar, but at the same time, they are different. A mythology is not a religion, but all religions will use mythology. I'm going to skip myth and art. Definitions by Karen Armstrong. Myths are universal and timeless stories that reflect the shape of our lives. They explore our desires, our fears, our longings, and provide narratives that remind us to what is meant to be human. I think that's a pretty good definition. This is my favorite one. Mythology is a system of narratives that confirms or informs, via ritual or disposition, basic and integral aspects of one's worldview to the end of achieving various levels and kinds of transcendence. Boom. You know those stories where you say, like, that person, like, locked themselves in a room before they understood this concept, or like that Michelangelo stared at that like slab for 6 months before he carved David. This is my carved David moment. It took me 3 weeks to come up with this definition. That's not an exaggeration. 3 weeks every day trying to figure out a good definition of mythology. So mythology is a system of narratives. It's not just one, it's usually a system of narratives, a bunch of stories. We use these stories to confirm or inform, basically to explain to us the significance of something or to assure us of the significance of that thing. Basic or integral aspects of one's worldview, so basic aspects of one's worldview. All rituals are rites of passage. So anytime you have a rite of passage in somebody's life, that would be an example of a basic aspect of one's worldview. But not just basic aspects of one's worldview, integral aspects of one's worldview. Where does the source of morality lie? Where is true hope? Where is true justice? Where does that come from? All those things are determined through myth. To the end of achieving various levels and kinds of transcendence. Now, it is good for you to enjoy, like, the day of your daughter's wedding. There is a type of transcendence that is in that day that you can't find anywhere else. But that's a different kind of transcendence than you trusting in Jesus Christ alone for salvation and being able to have access to Him because of His sacrifice on the cross. Those are different kinds and levels of transcendence. All right, any questions on the definition? Okay. I think I'm at least going to be able to make like my list of theological differences. So mythology and theology. I'm going to read. This is a really good quotation. Not only is myth the explanation of the rite, it is the same time, in part at least, the explanation of the God. So if you want to know something about a God, you look at the mythology, because the mythology is their theology in action. So think about it this way. The reason why I wanted to connect natural law and hero myth is natural law is this idea that there is this universal, unchanging notion of morality that is not dependent on people, but rather is dependent upon God. The fact that I think that notion of natural law should be connected to the same notion of hero myth, because if you create an ethical system based off of natural law, based off morality, the best way for you to theoretically implement that is with a hero myth. So here's what I mean by that. If you want to know if you can create a good ethical system, then create your ethical system and then write a story about a person that attempts to fulfill, via in practical situations, the different aspects of that ethical system that they created. And it'll tell you how good is that ethical system? Well, it's the same thing here. It's not only is a myth an explanation of a right, but it is an explanation of the God. So when you create the best way to test the ethical or mythological system is, does it correspond with what created that thing, the what it was trying to achieve, I'll say. So I say all that to say that a myth will tell us something about what is important to a religion, but it will also tell us about what is the motivation or the theology of the God that is behind that myth. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay. I'll finish the quotation. To the primitive minds, it is of such transcendent importance to get the ritual exactly right. Talked about before. Crucial. Ritual has to be right. It's almost like, see like The Aviator, and it was about Howard Hughes. I don't know how accurate it was, but, you know, when he was in his like crazed out, you know, long fingernail stage and they wanted to bring him food, he says, here's what you gotta do every time. He says, I'll say this number of times, and then you come in, you must do this, do that, and if you mess up at any point, we have to start all the way over again. Now that was taking it to an obsessive standpoint, but again, that's how they thought of rituals in the ancient world. Exactly right, the worshippers will not proceed one step without authority. And who is their authority? Well, the oldest tribesman within his memory. And so the tradition goes back and back, but it must end somewhere, and it ends at 1,000 instances how in an imaginary divine founder of that rite who becomes the center of the myth. So you must have a center of the myth. I think Christianity is the best job of explaining Yahweh or Christ, the Holy Spirit, as the center of all myth. So this brings up this idea of the monomyth. The monomyth, the best way I know how to explain it is two senses. One, it is the incurably religious aspects of humans and their desires for transcendence. Norm Geisler, he says that in his book on philosophy of religion. He says, people are incurably religious. You know, we are always doing things to bring about that transcendence. And I think there's no difference to say that if we say we're incurably religious, we could say easily we are incurably mythicists as well. So two aspects of the monomyth is all people have a desire to bring about transcendence. We're incurably religious. And it is the similar aspects inherent to all mythology. Joseph Campbell was the guy that came up with this. And his idea of the monomyth was there are these series of events that always occur if you're going to tell a complete story or as in a complete myth, and it's called the hero's journey or the hero's cycle, and it starts off with. There's a couple different ones, and I created actually my own hero's journey for the dissertation. But usually it begins with, you know, the hero in the ordinary world. And then he goes from the ordinary world to the special world. And so, like in Star Wars, when Luke Skywalker, even though he was still in the special world when he was on Tatooine before he started his journey, he didn't actually go into the special world until he decided to leave his farm and go off into adventure. So sometimes entering the special world, the hero doesn't even actually enter a special world. Wizard of Oz, that's an example of you actually have an ordinary world, and the hero goes physically into the special world, and it's completely different. But sometimes it's just implied. So anyways, there's these cycles that occur. That's what Joseph Campbell referred to as the monomyth. It's the one story. There's only one story that's told over and over again. The mono, one. It's the one myth. It's the hero's journey. and all we do is we either end it at different spots, you know, that maybe the hero dies a tragic death. So we either end it in different spots, or we don't try to tell the story of a hero. If you try to tell the story of a hero, and you try to tell the story of the best possible hero, you will talk about each of the different aspects of the monomyth or the hero's journey. Okay, introduction's done. I got like 10 minutes. Let's do this. Actually, it's still not, but sometimes I just be like, Matt, do you ever stop talking? Yeah, I know. Let's get to it. Myths and the Bible. What aspects of pagan mythology influence the biblical writers? What I want to do is I'm going to lay out these, and I'll give them real quick examples. But I think that really there's going to be three things that we could say that the New Testament was influenced by. Only one of those things, I would say, it actually influenced it, and the other two did not at all. What influenced the biblical writers? Actually, I say there's two things. The first thing is ancient Near East culture. Everything that happened in the Bible happened in the Near East culture. So everything that happened in that, we have to evaluate it in that mindset. So this means, like Paul will use pagan terminology and references when he is writing in the Bible. Now, the reason why Paul uses those terminologies is not advocating for that theology, but rather what he's saying is, in order for you to understand this concept, I am going to translate this word into something that you'll understand, and you'll understand it in that context. You know, one of the things I teach philosophy online, and one of the things I always tell my students is, I said, in one way for me to know, I don't mean this in a bad way at all, and she's not going to take it as a bad way, but I say, one way to know if I know something is, can I teach this thing to my mother? And it's not that my mom, don't get me wrong, my mom is brilliant, but she has not studied analytic philosophy. And so in order for me to explain something to her, I have to make these translations in my head. Now, these translations might not be the best way for me to translate these words or ideas, but when I translate them, I know that she will know what I am talking about based off of how I explain it to her. Same way that Paul did as well. I mean, he says, for I know that in me, that is within my flesh, nothing good dwells. And so then people like to say, oh, that word he used for flesh there, that is this pagan notion of flesh. So therefore, Paul has this view that the body is inherently bad or sinful. It's like, no, he's just using a word that they would understand. They have a non-scientific historical theory. Tacitus, he's considered the most best Roman historian to ever live. And yet Tacitus was known for, in a sense, fabricating entire speeches of politicians and putting them at events where that politician did not even speak. But he was not faulted for that. Now, could you imagine if a journalist did that today? And they were like, yeah, this Trump was in Iowa, and he's like in, you know, Singapore. But think about it this way. There's certain times when I've heard Doc speak that when I know he's going to do a subject, I'm like, okay, he's going to give this example. He's going to use these scriptures. He's going to tell this story. And so I could, let's say if Doc was even here today, and let's say he was going to talk on this subject. Well, if it's one of the subjects I know, I could give you almost that entire talk, attribute it to Dr. Fernandez. You all agree that it's Dr. Fernandez, but we would also all agree that we do not record history that way. Well, we don't now, but in the ancient world, that's how they did it. You were able to, in a sense, you could create an entire speech and it wouldn't be an example of you fabricating if in the sense that it is something that they would say. Now, I say all that to say that idea is true in the ancient Near East, but now it's being taken too far. You have some people, like right now, I don't know if you guys are following this, but like there are people saying that like Gospel of John that, like, these are like New Testament guys that are 1,000 times smarter than I'll ever be, but they'll be like, Jesus never said any of the I am statements in John. That those are just pure, that the gospel writers know that that thing is kind of true, and so what they did was they put those words into his mouth and they had him say it. Now, what's different about what I talked about before is everything that I would say about Doc is something that he had said. But these people are kind of like allegorizing entire sermons of Jesus, saying that he's never said this before, but these ideas he's kind of mentioned that. That's not what I'm talking about. I think that the other end, if you guys want to read Lydia McGrew, she's been doing really good stuff on this. But one of the things that she argues for is, you know, she doesn't think that, you know, all the, like we see in the Gospels, she doesn't think that those are, you know, in a sense, word for word things that Jesus said, you know, every single sermon. But at the same time, she's saying, you know, this whole idea of saying that the biblical authors were given free rein to take these things any way they wanted to is completely false. And I agree with that. I'm not going to get into these because I want to leave room for question. So I'll say this. The sharing of the culture will result in the sharing of similar mythical themes. However, correlation does not entail causation. You know, I've read these guys who, like, it says, like, it'll use certain words in the Bible to say, like, Leviathan. And depending on the context, Leviathan can mean many different things. And most of the times when it's using it, it's either talking about literally, like, big fish in the ocean, like, you know, whales, or not fish, but you know what I mean. Or it's talking about, like, metaphorically, like, dragons, you know. So there'll be people who say, oh, this, they use this word Leviathan, and there is this, ancient Near East myth about Baal, and it mentions the word Leviathan. Therefore, the Bible stole from this myth. I'm like, no. Just because they mention this thing in common, it doesn't mean correlation does not entail causation. So the reason for the similarities, in the cultural sense, God is always in the business of proving himself and his worldview to be superior. This results in the acclamation of titles, feats of superiority, and uniqueness. So what I mean by the reason why they're similar is God is always showing himself to be God. And how he does that is, the first thing he does is he acquires titles. So, for example, if you were to look up this title, you guys have heard of this title before, the Lord of Hosts. You've heard of that title, right? Okay, so the Lord of Hosts is a title that is given to God. In the specific first context we see it in, he's referring to an army of angels. But I've read some commentaries on it that say that the host doesn't mean a lot of angels at God's back. It means every fabric of reality, all the host of reality, the various atoms, the subatomic molecules, all that is what means that God is the Lord of Hosts. It means that he is basically sovereign of all reality. Now, another myth that is given the title Lord of Hosts is Zeus. And this goes back to the ancient Greek notion of Xenia. X-E-N-I-A. And what that was guest-host relationship. In the ancient world, this bordered on contractual. So what I mean by that, so if you were to, like, you know, sign a contract with somebody and you make that agreement to them, if it's contractual, it's more significant. Well, Xenia was the ancient notion of guest-host relationship that all Greeks would partake in. And how they would partake in it is, depending on who you were, you would either take on the role of a guest or a host. And I'm not going to get into all the parts of it, but if somebody asked to be your host, you were, like, morally obligated to accept them and to take care of them. This has happened on the battlefield. Like, Achilles, like, he didn't partake in Xenia properly because when is it Patroclus? When he asked for mercy, Achilles denied him. Under Xenia, he's not allowed to do that. But one of the titles of Zeus is Lord of Hosts. Why was he given that title? Because he is supposed to oversee Xenia, or the idea of guest-host relationship, on a global scale. Now I ask you, who better applies the title of Lord of Hosts? Zeus, who says, I'm going to look at the world and kind of make sure that you guys are all following these general rules? Or is it Yahweh, who says, all of reality is subject to me? Well, I think that title fits a lot better with Yahweh. And you see that with other titles too. The Good Shepherd. Good Shepherd, in the ancient Near East mindset, was a kingly term. It was used as somebody who oversaw the sovereignty of his people. Again, okay, overseeing the sovereignty of your people. Who, even theoretically, could do better than actually Yahweh and being the Good Shepherd? No one. So God ends up acquiring all these titles. But what happens is people say, oh, Lord of Hosts. Wait a second. Zeus is called Lord of Hosts. So did the biblical writers, did they copy from Zeus? It's like, no. The biblical writer says, look, our idea of God, it makes more sense that he is the Lord of Hosts because all of reality is subject to him. So, all right, let me just stop right there. I'm going to go through and just, I want to say, so what I do think influenced the New Testament writers, besides the ancient Near East culture, is also the pagan philosophy. Now, when I say pagan, let me explain real quick, specifically the Socratic philosophy of Plato. I had this whole section where I was going to go into explaining all the similarities between the Apostle Paul's theology and Plato's theology, but I ran out of time for that. But what doesn't influence them are the mystery religions, which I'm not going to be able to talk about, and Gnosticism. Now, ultimately, those are there to influence the New Testament scholars, writers, but they ultimately didn't. And the reason why I would say they didn't is because these are the main theological differences between the Israel and the New Testament church and the ancient Near East religions. So this is the backing behind the mythology is different all across the board. You have polytheism versus monotheism, descriptive ethics versus prescriptive ethics. Basically, with descriptive ethics, you can't really tell anybody this is how you have to act. Well, with the theology behind polytheism, you can't get prescriptive ethics. You can only get descriptive ethics. You can only say, this is why you acted this way, not you should act this way. A low view of humanity and body versus a high view of humanity. In the ancient world, the idea of humans having value is so far beyond us. They would never consider a human having value. And the same thing, they always consider the body as bad. Whereas Christianity, there's a high view of humans and a high view of the body. The body is good. It's the only religion I know of that says that you will have a physical body in the afterlife. And yet that body is still pure. They're saying you can have a sinless physical body. I don't know of any religion that says you can have a sinless physical body. Rationality is discouraged versus rationality being encouraged. Chaotic versus a rational universe. The whole reason why we can do science is because of Christianity, because only with Christianity can you have a rational backing for a universe. But the only way you're going to be able to have scientific thought is if you have a rational universe. But the ancient notion of the universe was that it was chaotic. There was no ultimate rational backing, which is also related to this. There's eternal matter versus finite matter, icons versus iconoclasm. You know, in ancient Near East, ancient Israel, they were so against creating God in a graven image, they wouldn't even touch it. Whereas all the pagan myths, they were just like, oh yeah, we'll create a statue for this. And you know, G.K. Chesterton, he talks about this in Everlasting Man, and he even says the reason why is because eventually all pagan icons and idols devolve into phallic symbols. And so he says the reason why, part of the reason why that God said, don't make an image of me, is he says all these other religions, they eventually go down, devolve into a phallic symbol. And God's like, I'm not just your means of reproducing. I am not just your means of thriving. He's like, I'm your God, and you're not going to reduce me to this, just this stupid image. Hidden or debased rituals versus open and pure rituals. I mean, Augustine talked about that. It's like 88th letter. I forget what it was. He's going off on like how obscene this pagan ritual is and how it's just so debased. I mean, Paul talks about that in his letters to the Corinthians as well. Whereas the rituals of Christianity, the most sacred rituals of Christianity are well known. They're out in the open. It's the Eucharist, baptism, and marriage. Those are the three most sacred rituals in Christianity, and they are not hidden. They are in the open. Whereas the mystery religions, you know, these guys, it's so funny. They're saying, hey, Christianity copied from these mystery religions. And I was like, oh, what did they copy? Well, I don't know. It's like, well, why don't you know? And it's like, well, they're the mystery religions. Exactly. So how are you going to say they copied it? And then finally, what I talked about earlier, sentiments of transcendence versus actual transcendence, which is salvation. So that's it. If you guys have any other questions, I'll be around for a bit. So yeah, God bless you guys. Thank you.